Our presentation is The Social Regulation of Speech by Francisco Coleman. It relates to our fourth principle of free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Dr. Coleman is an assistant professor of constitutional law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and the associate director of the East Asian Legal Studies Center. She is an interdisciplinary scholar whose work draws upon political theory, critical discourse analysis, and constitutional law. After she speaks, we will have a time of discussion and questions. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Coleman.
So I will just share my screen at this time. Tiny pictures. So first, just a warning, I have a dog. He's in another room, but he's very angry. So he may decide to interject himself through barking into this presentation. Okay. Also, my mouse is very sensitive. So this presentation is based on an article I wrote that was, they should be fired. But then I realized, well, these days people have been canceled. So they should be canceled, the social regulation of free speech in the US. So I'm gonna just have three parts to this presentation. First, to kind of introduce you to what I mean by the social regulation of speech. Then to discuss, you know, how it works, why we have it, and how it's become distorted. And then a proposal for how we can improve the social regulation of speech. So first, you know, everyone talks about free speech, and that makes it a highly controversial issue. And I think, you know, one thing I always tell my students is constitutional free speech does not mean the speech is costless, right? It doesn't mean the speech is actually free. It's a provision about who can penalize your speech, right? And so whatever cost there are to your speech, they are imposed privately and socially, not legally and by the government. And so that's, I think, a huge clarification that's needed when we think about the protection of free speech in the US. So that, you know, that difference implies that there are two ways speech is regulated. And so one of the things that I mentioned in my article is that speech is not unregulated in the US, it's just regulated socially rather than legally. So legal regulation is about, you know, citizens, you elect your legislatures, they make laws that regulate speech. Those, you know, violation of those laws are sanctioned through the legal process, either by a government actor or by a jury of your peers, right? So there is this whole legal mechanism that goes along with the legal regulation of speech. So if you were in South Africa and you're on, you know, there was a woman on the beach, you know, and she mentioned that the Black people on the beach were little monkeys, and she was taken to equality court. And so at the equality court, right, her speech was sanctioned. She had to do some community service. She had to pay some fines, right? So that's how legal regulation of speech works. In the US, right, you know, what you would have is someone finding out, oh, she works for, you know, First American Bank or something. And you would contact First American Bank with maybe a video of her making that comment. And then you would rely on the citizens to pressure First American Bank to like fire her or something, right? And so that's the difference between the legal and social regulation. One is citizens imposing sanctions through the government and law, and the other is citizens imposing sanctions through institutions and civil society and setting norms and customs on a case-by-case basis as opposed to through law. So how does social regulation of speech work? Well, publicity, right? So first of all, you need to know that the person has, you know, violated the speech code. So you need to get that out into the public, right? And so it's not always the case. Like if you're at a private dinner and no one has you on video, you don't tweet anything, it's very difficult for social regulation of speech to work. But if you tweet it, if someone has you on video, that's going to be the trigger for the operation of the social regulation of speech. And so once your speech is out there, once people know about it, then you're gonna have pressure. In the ideal world, which I'll talk about in another slide, the pressure is local. So like local people are going to respond to this video. They're going to respond to this tweet or to this Facebook post, and they're going to try to put pressure on you in one of two ways. Either they'll put pressure on you directly by having found out, like, you know, this person is, you know, believes in white supremacy and they're coming to our campus and they're going to be speaking. Then they're going to, you know, put pressure on you directly, maybe by barricading, you know, the door to the venue and not allowing you to have access. If it's more, you know, that your speech is just, you know, a one-off thing on Twitter or Facebook, they may contact whatever institution is affiliated with you and ask that institution to fire or suspend you. So they try to bring some pressure, and then that pressure either works or not. So there are some sanctions. Either you can't get into the venue to give your speech, you're shouted down, and so you give up, or you're fired from your job or suspended. So that's how social regulation of speech works. So the ideal, right? So it may seem like, oh, is this what we want? Do we want legal regulation or do we want social regulation? One of the good things about social regulation is that it actually fits better with the reasons why America says we have free speech. So the reasons why we have free speech, there are three rationales. One is it promotes self-government, right? And so what that means is government by the people, right? People governing themselves. And so if the people are governing themselves, you want whatever kind of censorship is happening to be the people, you know, maybe censoring and exercising power over the government, not the government censoring and exercising power over the people, right? So that self-government is kind of like the government based at the individual level, while citizens are in charge and in control. Next, you have the truth seeking, our marketplace of ideas. And so the idea is that, you know, let's all put our ideas out there and let's figure out which ideas work, which ideas are best, which ideas make sense given our situation. And so the more ideas you have to play around with, the more likely that the right idea is going to be expressed. Whereas if you have censorship, maybe there will be something false in the marketplace, but all of the ideas that are trying to reveal that falsity are shut down. And so you can't actually get the truth out there. And so one of the examples I think is like Galileo and the Catholic Church, right? And he's trying to tell certain truths about the world, but they can't get out there because of the censorship. The third rationale is self-expression, self-autonomy, and that the way we express ourselves, right, is through speech and language and communication. And so limits on speech and language and communication are also going to be speech on our ability to express ourselves. You know, one kind of argument made by philosophers is that, you know, when we're about in society, we're living out a story, right, about who we are, right? And we try to communicate to other people this narrative of our existence. And so if you have restrictions on expression, then that's going to, in some ways, limit the ways in which people can express themselves. So given those three rationales for speech, you know, the idea is that social regulation, unlike legal regulation, is more partial and local. So it's not like some kind of, you know, statewide rule or citywide rule or national rule, but actually it's rule imposed by the people in your community, which we think is more limited and more partial just because the community doesn't have the power of the government in its hands all at once. The other reason is that if you have this kind of partial and localized approach to speech, then you'll end up with different speech communities. And so even if a certain way of talking and speaking is not permitted in this community, there should be another community where it is. And so the marketplace will still have opportunity to consider and evaluate these ideas. And then the last one, the initiative lies with the government, with the people, and not with the government. So that's the ideal. The problem is in the area of social media and polarization, we are not living in that idealized world. And so there are three primary problems. So one is, you know, the speech that is offensive. There are three types of speech that is offensive. That sanctioned. I did a small qualitative study. And in that study, there were kind of three primary types of speech that caused people to get fired. One was speech that can be censored. So that's like hate speech. The other was speech that is contested. So this is speech that one group in society thinks this is political speech that should be protected. And another group in society thinks this is hate speech that should be censored. So it's contested. And these groups kind of actually shift off in having power. And so you might think about Black Lives Matter. Like some people are like, yes, Black Lives Matter is a political slogan that really gets to the heart of the problems of racism in America. But you have a huge number of people who think Black Lives Matter is some kind of call for discrimination against European Americans. And so just think about how Colin Kaepernick was treated, right? Some people were like, he's a hero. And other people were like, he should leave the country. And so that's contested speech. And then there's speech that is discreditable. And that's just speech that we find rude, callous, and insensitive. And so one example is, and for Halloween, I think shortly after the Boston Marathon bombings, a college student thought it would be a good idea for her Halloween costume to be, you know, I am a victim of the Boston Marathon bombing. And so that was very callous and very insensitive, but it wasn't hate speech. But all of these types of speech, whether it's censored, contested, or discreditable, the remedy is the same. They, you know, people call for the person to be fired. And so that's one size fits all in terms of the remedy, but the injury caused by these different types of speech is actually not the same. And so it's problematic that dressing up like a Boston Marathon bomber is treated a Boston Marathon victim is treated the same as like calling someone a racial slur. Those are just different levels of offensiveness and different levels of harm, but social regulation doesn't have gradations. It's just one size fits all. So there's no proportionality. And there's also no consistency because it really depends on who sees your speech and how motivated they are to bring public attention to it. And then one of the problems is the reason we have a Bill of Rights. The goal of the Bill of Rights is to say, there's some rights that are so important, we don't want them to be taken away or sanctioned in the heat of the moment. Right? And so they're constitutional rights. So in order to sanction them, you kind of have to go through these stages of the judicial process. And hopefully, right, there will be a cooling down period. And so you won't have this kind of gut instinct to abridge people's rights. And so you put them in the Constitution and you say, these are rights that should not be abridged in the heat of the moment. And you're going to slow down that process. But social regulation of speech is very much a heat of the moment type of regulation. And so to the extent that we think speech is very, very important, right, and that speech is a fundamental right, it's problematic that social regulation of speech is a heat of the moment type of regulation. Okay, so non-ideal continued. Local censorship is no longer local, right? You have social media, so if I'm in Alabama, you know, the people censoring my speech, not just people in Alabama, maybe people in Alabama liked the speech, right? So I, you know, post it and I get people in New York, right, to kind of, you know, write letters to Bank of America or tweets to, you know, American Airlines and express, you know, how they are very upset, or to Delta or whoever, right? And so whatever this national corporation is, even if the people in Alabama like my speech, if there's just a minority in Alabama that can reach out to a national audience, then you can get these national norms. But then that puts us in a situation where, okay, you know, the whole reason we like social regulation of speech is because we want any sanctions to kind of be local and community-based. But social media makes them very, very national. And so social media kind of combined with, you know, the national or multinational corporations and media concentration, right? Like, you know, six companies control 90% of the media. So we don't always, you know, kind of see the effects of that. But there have been some high profile cases, you know, like the Dixie Chicks who couldn't get on to radio because the CEO, I think maybe Sinclair Broadcasting, you know, was offended by their criticism of, you know, George Bush. And he owned so many radio stations that it was possible to keep their music off the air. So you don't see these types of things. Like, that's a blatant example. But you don't see that often. But you can see it a little bit more these days because of Facebook and Twitter, right? And so, you know, who is it? Maybe Jack Dorsey. I'm not sure who owns Twitter. But, you know, he can wake up one day and say, you know, Trump has just gone too far. And, you know, you're off of Twitter, and the millions of people who follow you no longer have access to your words. Not to say they need to, these are good words that should be out there. But the idea that the power of individuals, right, is extremely high in terms of setting, of having their particular view of appropriate speech being imposed on a kind of national or multinational scale. And I think a similar thing happened with maybe Cloudflare, and they kind of denied service to the Daily Stormer, whereupon that particular site found it very difficult to even be on the internet. And we may think that, well, that's a good outcome, but I think the process and that much power in the hands of a person, I mean, even the CEO himself said, you know, it is troubling that I can wake up one morning and say this person shouldn't be on the internet, right? And that, I think, is highly problematic. If one of our values is that we want a marketplace and we want a diversity of perspectives, then maybe we don't want one or two people being able to mediate and decide which perspectives are allowed into the marketplace. We want it to be more, more diverse group of voices. The kind of main non-ideal effect, of course, is the cancellation and what happens when people are canceled. And what happens when people are canceled, unfortunately, is that they leave a marketplace in which there are diverse perspectives and they end up in these little silos, right? And in these silos, they only talk to like-minded people, right? And they don't encounter any rebuttal, right? There is no critique, there is no back and forth. And so their ideas, right, that were kind of subject to some kind of, you know, validity checks in the larger marketplace, end up, right, being expressed in these silos, and they become the worst versions of themselves, right? And so that's, you know, a side effect, and it undermines the marketplace of ideas, because instead of having everybody in the marketplace fighting over the ideas, right, people with idea A go to this silo, and people with idea B go to this silo, and people with idea C go to this silo, and then who's left in the marketplace, right? And so this really destroys the marketplace of ideas. Another problem, of course, is one of the things free speech has always tried to do is to kind of get more speakers, right? Because the more speakers you have, the more ideas you have, the more likely it is that you're gonna get this good idea rising to the top. Unfortunately, the problem is you can get more speakers, but you can't give people more time, right? And so you have way more information, same 24 hours in a day. So what happens, right? Is this, are all of these new speakers, are we thinking critically about what they're saying? Are we reading and cross-checking and going to Snopes.com or whatever, you know, truth check you use to check the validity of this information? No. Once you get so much information, you start taking shortcuts. And a lot of times the shortcut is, who is the speaker, right? Which silo produced this idea, right? So if this idea was on CNN, I can trust it. If it was on Fox News, I can't trust it, right? And so you're not even, you know, you're not even reading the article anymore, right? You're just saying, oh, this is a Fox News article. I don't have to engage with it. And so that, I think, is problematic, right? And it's not, and so it contributes to the polarization, but part of the problem is just there is so much information out there. You have to make choices about what you read and what you give your time to. And it's, you know, one of the shortcuts that's most popular is to give your time to information produced by people with whom you already agree. Okay, so, the final, like, non-ideal is our whole free speech apparatus in some ways really depends on some assumptions about what happens in the marketplace. And the whole reason, you know, people who are like free speech absolutists who don't want any kind of regulation of speech is because they really believe, right, that this market is going to produce truth, right? But one argument is the market doesn't reflect truth. In some ways, it just reflects the preferences of those with power, right? The other, this I think is more problematic, is, you know, the idea that if we get more ideas into the marketplace, people are going to use their reason, right? And they're going to distinguish between good ideas and bad ideas based on rationality and reason. But unfortunately, we know that the strongest appeals are not appeals based on reason. It's appeals based on emotion, appeals to emotion. That's what gets people going, right? And so there are some assumptions about the marketplace of ideas that are not true. And I think the flaws in those assumptions are kind of exacerbated in the kind of social media environment. But I am not a person who says, well, let's just get rid of social regulation. I'm a person who wants to improve social regulation. I think social regulation has some pluses. But before I go into my solution to how we can improve social regulation, I do just want to underscore like a key difference in how the US kind of got here. So one of the reasons the US is a no legal regulation regime, which, you know, then we end up with social regulation. But the reason we're a no legal regulation regime is because of this idea that when the US was in the process of figuring out what the First Amendment meant, the civil rights movement was going on. A lot of Southern jurisdictions were trying to sue Northern newspapers for reporting on the civil rights movement. And they were very nitpicky. Oh, you said Dr. King was arrested 7 times and he was only arrested 4. That's libel. We can sue you for millions of dollars. Well, what would be millions of dollars today? Back then it was probably like $500,000. And so what the US did was, because Southern government officials were trying to use kind of free speech and the idea that, you know, the speech of the newspapers was harming their reputation, the US took an approach of leveling down. Like, nobody is entitled to any kind of special protection of their reputation when what's under discussion is some kind of public issue or when they are public figures, right? So we leveled down. And they leveled down because they were trying to keep Southern officials from using their dignitary interest to prevent reporting on the civil rights movement. In Europe, you ended up with legal regulation going a different way, where they said, you know, they were dealing with anti-Semitism. And so they conceptualized legal regulation as necessary to protect the dignity interests of minorities. In the US, you have a population that's moving towards, we need to protect people's dignity, right? But because of how the Constitution has been interpreted, we can't use the law to level up, right? The law is like, everyone is leveled down, no one is entitled to dignitary interests. So you have to use social regulation of speech in order to try to level up. But this is normally not how social regulation of speech is used. People who want to level up everyone, who want to protect dignity, they normally do that through law. And so in the US, what's happening is people are trying to do through social norms and, you know, what most nations do through legal norms. And that is a very fraught process. And it's very counterintuitive and very difficult to implement. So my argument is, we have to be very thoughtful. We can't just assume it's gonna happen. Like, people will be born, you know, they will go through life and they will just know how to do social regulation of speech that levels up and protects dignity. That's just not an assumption that is good to make, because you need a standard. What does it mean to protect dignity? What kinds of speech infringe dignity? It's, you know, normally people set these things out in law. So we know, okay, this is harming dignity, this is insult, and they define these terms. And I think you need to give society, if you're going to do it in a more ad hoc social way, people need some ideas of what these concepts mean. What does it mean to harm someone through speech? And if you're just letting each person with a cell phone decide that themselves and make emotional appeals, you just end up, I think, with a very chaotic and in some ways oppressive regime, because you don't know what you can say where, right? Okay, so how do we try to fix social regulation speech? We have to choose a place and time in society where we teach citizens how to engage in the social regulation of speech, right? If we, you know, if we have this, like everyone's leveled down, right? So when you're in school, everyone's leveled down. And so there's certain things you can say unless you're disruptive. When you're in college, everyone's leveled down. You can say whatever you want. We don't care about dignity. And then you get to work and you're fired, right? Because suddenly the people around you care about dignity. I think we need a space in which we communicate to citizens the importance of dignity and how we want to protect it in American society. And so I think I'm kind of an outlier here. I think the place to do that, I would like to say the place to do that is high school, but in America, high schools are highly, highly segregated. I think about 70% of, you know, white students go to a school that's majority white. 90 something percent of minority students go to schools that are minority students. So you don't, the likelihood of you actually encountering like perspectives that are opposed to your own and actually being called out on kind of your socialization into racism or misogyny or whatever is very low at the high school level. So maybe when, you know, high schools become more integrated, that would be the place to teach this. But until then, I think for many students, the first place they encounter meaningful diversity, right? And the first place in which their socialization into various forms of oppression begins to be challenged by other students is the university. But right now under the First Amendment, because we have this legal regulation that levels down as opposed to legal regulation that seeks to level up, that means that on these university campuses, many public university campuses, the school is prohibited from making any kind of regulation of speech. And so the students have no option but to call for nationwide boycotts and to, you know, barricade the doors to keep, they don't have any other options. And so I think we could make university spaces where students learn maybe a body of techniques for social regulation of speech, where they learn and think about how, what type of speech is truly offensive, where they kind of learn to do these gradations, right? Between, you know, speech that is censorable and speech that is just rude, right? They don't require the same type, I think, of sanctions. So I think universities should have speech codes. I think the speech code should be oriented not towards just social regulation, like, oh, you know, private universities can have speech codes. And normally the way they work, you know, you are not tolerant, so get out of our community, right? We're withdrawing your scholarship. We're withdrawing your offer of admissions. And I think that just sends the people to silos. It's not really helpful. Instead, I think universities should approach the social regulation of speech with a reconciliation type of approach, where we're going to have speech codes on both public university campuses and private university campuses. But the content of those speech codes and the direction of those speech codes is going to be towards reconciliation and integration into the community, right? So that you have made a racial slur, right? We're not going to first say, oh, you hate Black people and so we should kick you out, right? Because I think there was some quote, he was modifying another quote, but basically he said, you know, don't attribute to malice what can adequately be explained by stupidity, right? And so I don't want to, you know, say stupidity is what we're dealing with, but I think there is ignorance, right? There's a lack of knowledge. And so sometimes what we're treating as malice toward a particular group is really lack of knowledge of that group. And so in our sanctions on university campuses, instead of just immediately, you know, excluding the person from the community, a first step should be to try to remedy the failures in their knowledge, because that's what universities do, right? They're institutes of education, and we try to educate. And I think this is an area in which education is desperately needed. And so there could be some kind of community service. There could be some kind of dialogue with groups with whom they differ, from whom they differ. And I think that would be a better approach than maybe just this exclusion. Okay. So my idea, both groups, like they are the speech code people and the no speech code people, don't like my idea. The people who want speech codes, right, they want the person excluded from the community because they say, oh, you know, you can't talk people out of being racist. Like, they're racist. We need to get them out of the community. And they say, you know, while you're trying to rehabilitate them, the minority students are suffering. And so, you know, in order to help the minority students, we just have to get rid of these people. The no speech code people are just like, why do you want a speech code? Like, you're infringing their liberty. You're like imposing, you know, norms in society upon people. And you're limiting their self-expression. So my response is, I told you in the beginning, to the speech code people is, you know, this is not always malice. Sometimes it's ignorance, and ignorance requires a different approach. There are different ways you protect students from ignorance than you protect students from malice. I think you have to have a heavier hand when you're protecting students from malice, but I think you can have a softer touch when you're protecting students from ignorance. I think having a democracy presupposes growth and that the citizenry can learn, right? And I think if people can't learn and change, then we cannot have a democratic form of government, right? But democracy assumes that in conversation with each other, right? In exchanging reason and ideas, people's minds are changing, right? And if that's not possible, then we have a far deeper problem than whether or not we should have a speech code. And then, you know, taking these concerns seriously is not about being content with silent hostility. We don't just want people to, you know, go to their silo and say the racial slurs and just, you know, as long as you don't say them to me, I'm fine. No, we actually want more than just hostility that is silence. We want to try to move towards respectful engagement and sympathy. And that can only happen if we are engaging with each other. And of course, for the people who just want no speech code at all, then I think they are just assuming, right, that the First Amendment requires speech to be costless. And it's not going to be costless. And I think it's better to have informed imposition of cost than to have just random vigilante roving imposition of cost. And so if the choice is between cost imposed by an uninformed citizenry and cost imposed by an informed citizenry, then I think the choice has to be the informed citizenry. And the only way you're going to get them informed is you're going to have some standards that they are taught and that is enforced. So, conclusion. University students are learners, right? That's why I'm in education. I tell my students, you know, I believe in your ability to learn and change. If I did not, I would not be here. So I feel that way strongly about students, but I feel that way also about, you know, wider society. But the location of my solution is the university, because I think students have come there to learn. And I think we should never underestimate the power of sympathy. You know, I recall one person saying that his grandfather was basically a racist, and the only Black person he liked or he acknowledged was a Black person who like lived across the street, right? And there's something about the people you know and knowledge of others, I think, that promotes an understanding of shared humanity across difference. And I think we shouldn't underestimate the power of that, and we should try to encourage that. And so I think my solution of having speech codes on campuses and enforcing those speech codes in a way that promotes sympathy is a way to get out of the cancel culture hole that we're in. So that is my my presentation, and I'm willing to answer any questions you may have. I mean, I think that's a worthwhile aspiration to have this in high school. I think I would just say, like, one of the limitations of having in high school now is that I just don't think that it's something that can just be taught. I think in order for these lessons to really stick, you need exposure to people who are different. And unfortunately, in high school, you know, you have all of these private schools, right? And so people who, you know, I don't know if it's 30% in private high schools. I'm not sure, but I'm not sure that the percentage of people in the public high schools is so dramatically different from the percentage of people that go to college. But I do think if you have, the goal should be to have integrated high schools and, yeah, teach this in high school. But I think you have to have diversity in the context, because otherwise it's just words that go in one ear, not the other. If you're not around people who challenge you to actually apply what you're learning. But definitely high school's curriculum, I am on board with like changing a lot of stuff. I think cancel culture, power, right? Your power in society matters a lot more when the regulation is social, right? So yeah, so if you're some kind of celebrity, you're gonna rebound and be able to resist your cancellation than if you're just some ordinary person, you know, harassing a guy in a park about putting a leash on your dog, right? So you may not rebound from being canceled to the same degree as somebody who's very, very high profile. And so I think power, you know, can affect how legal regulations work, but I think it may have a greater effect on social regulation because power is more influential in kind of social norms and social context. So yeah, I would agree. But I would say, you know, for me, I view my intervention as limited, right? And so my idea is, you know, this is how we make the future different. Now for the present, I actually leave that to other scholars. And so I don't have an intervention for the current people. But one thing that I do say is that, you know, we can't keep doing the same things that produced those people and expect the next generation to be different, right? And so if we want a different type of society than the one we have now, we have to start doing something different. But as for how to change the current society, that's not something my solution doesn't address that. The level up, level down language is, I forget the scholar's name, but basically the idea is that in Europe, when they were facing kind of challenges, they decided as a matter of law that everyone in society was entitled to this kind of respect that was normally given to aristocrats, right? So they had this aristocratic culture, right, of like people's honor and their dignity, but it was only for aristocrats. But when they begin to deal with like anti-Semitism, you know, in the post-World War era, they decided that, you know, we're going to require this kind of solicitude for people's dignity, you know, and it's not limited to aristocrats. But you know how this kind of, you know, it's just like the aristocratic culture. You know, if you insult me, right, we have to have a duel, right? That was this kind of idea that this personal honor was so important. And what the scholar said was that that concept of personal honor in Europe became kind of transferred to the way they deal with hate speech. And so they were much more protective in their positive law of these kind of dignitary harms. Because when you're talking about an insult to my honor, right, you're talking about these dignitary harms. And so I can give you some examples. If you kind of, there was a newspaper that misquoted someone, right? And it wasn't like a huge misquote, but it was a misquote that infringed his honor, infringed his reputation. So of course, that was something that was penalized. You think about, I think there was a picture, maybe that there was some kind of nudity for like maybe one of the members of British royalty. And those pictures could not be published in Europe because of her personal honor, but they could be published, you know, in America. And so there's this idea that insult to your dignity as a human. There are so many laws in Germany and the UK that allow those types of dignitary harms inflicted by speech to be remedied at law. Whereas in the US, you know, you just think about, what is it, Snyder versus Phelps, right? Where you're having a funeral for your son and there are people outside with like flags saying, thank God your son has, you know, is dead. Thank God for dead soldiers. There is no remedy for that. Like the Supreme Court was like almost unanimous in saying there's no remedy. But if it were in Europe, that is such an insult to their honor. That's such an insult to their dignity that would not have been allowed. So when I say level up, it's the concept that in the UK, everyone becomes an aristocrat and you cannot insult their honor. Whereas in the US, no one is aristocrat. And so, you know, you just, you know, you have no honor. You know, that could be insulted. So I don't know if that helps.
Thank you. I would like everyone to join me in thanking Dr. Coleman for a really thought-provoking talk today.
Thank you.